listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, big oil has gotten a little smaller in recent years. We'll look at the declining role of oil producers in our global economy over the last decade and what the future could hold. Now, after yesterday's state Supreme Court ruling, clerks across Wisconsin can move forward on mailing more than 1 million ballots to voters. Justices ruled 4-3 to keep Green Party presidential candidate Howie Hawkins off the ballot. Last week, they ordered clerks to stop sending ballots until the matter was resolved. Had the court ruled in Hawkins' favor, at least 2.3 million ballots would have had to have been reprinted. The majority opinion said that would have led to confusion among voters who had already received, maybe even returned, their original ballots. In response, Hawkins said, quote, "We got screwed." The case was being watched closely because of how tight the election is expected to be and the prospect that Hawkins might siphon votes from Democrats in particular. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Charlie, good to have you back with us.
Nice to be here, Rob.
Well, it was a tangled road to get here, Charlie. What's your reaction to the outcome?
I mean, it seems to me that the court was trying to weigh the ramifications and the effects of interjecting themselves into this process. I mean, one of the fundamental issues with the question that they were being asked to resolve was sort of what's going to be fair, what's going to be sort of a resolution that's actually going to work. And I think the biggest problem for the court was that the time frame was so compressed, and because we're facing such an unusual election, that if they decided to delay and to force the state to go back and reprint a bunch of ballots, that it may have impacted the election in such a problematic way that we might be viewed as sort of one of these outlier states where we don't know whether or not we had an accurate count, whether or not we had an appropriate election conducted. And I think that while you sense in the majority opinion that they were sympathetic to the Green Party arguments, at the same time, their hands were tied because of limitations related to printing of ballots and distributing them to the voters, both here and overseas.
And the Green Party candidates didn't get on ultimately because of a technicality, which technicalities, I guess, are important. I think their vice presidential candidate changed the address, and that made that muddled basically their signature collection process. They didn't resolve it initially when given the chance. There's got to be feeling, if you're a Green Party candidate, I imagine, that the outcome was unfair to them. How do you tackle that?
Well, certainly, in many ways, you can view it through that lens. But as the Green Party knows, and the Libertarian Party knows, and the Constitution Party knows, every party in every state that attempts to get on a ballot is hamstrung by the rules that are created by the two dominant parties in the state. Why would any party that overwhelms the system want to grant entry to another party that might siphon votes or might upend an apple cart that the two major parties have been accustomed to dragging along the election process for all these years? So while I am sympathetic, and I think the court was too, about the rules and the way in which they were applied, the difficulty is this is just sort of baked into the way in which the system works, trying to get the requisite number of signatures in order to get on a ballot. And it goes deeper than that in the election process about who gets to participate in debates, when they get to participate in debates, whether or not they're automatically on the ballot in the following election cycle, depending upon how many votes you receive. So, you know, this is kind of a hurdle that exists constantly for minor parties in the United States. It frustrates voters who want to see a third or fourth party option to try to blunt some of the effects of the two major parties. So, you know, this is something that's just been hanging around American politics for most of our history.
Now, the Hawkins campaign for the Green Party said they couldn't find a lawyer from the usual progressive law suspects. They ended up working with a law firm that usually works with Republicans. Kanye West, the performer trying to get on Wisconsin's ballot, some Republican names helped him try to do that. He also ended up falling short, it looks like, at this point. The assumption there by Republicans is that having a Green Party candidate on and maybe Kanye West hurts Democrats, and Democrats seem to agree with that assessment and didn't want to get those on the ballot. Do you think that's accurate? Do you think those candidates would hurt Democrats and help Republicans?
So if you look back at 2016, because, you know, Hillary Clinton and her campaign is still stung by, you know, the votes that seemed to have been sucked from her her column over to Trump, or at least aided Trump in 2016. You know, most of the exit polls that were analyzed after the 2016 election, it wasn't as though people who were voting for the Green Party candidate, Stein, were doing so because they were switching their votes from Hillary. And if Stein hadn't been on the ballot, they would have voted for Hillary. They were voting for Stein because they wouldn't have shown up otherwise. So it's not an either or in the sense of I'm going to vote for one candidate or another. It's this was the only choice I had. So, you know, if that kind of pattern would hold in this election, my suspicion is that if Hawkins isn't on the ballot, the people who would have voted for the Green Party slate are just going to stay home because really he's attractive to those individuals who would have voted for Bernie Sanders. I mean, he's a socialist and he is advocating a $20 minimum wage. He's advocating Medicare for all. And a lot of people are off put by Joe Biden because he is not liberal enough. And I'm not sure whether or not they want to go to the polls and pull a lever for Biden. They probably would just stay home.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs, political science professor at St. Norbert College in Napier, looking at the outcome of this challenge that put Wisconsin ballot printing and mailing on hold for a bit. It is now spinning back into gear after a state Supreme Court ruling affirming that the Green Party should stay off the ballot because of a decision made by the state's main election commission. All right, Charlie, these ballots are being mailed. We're going to see, I think, again, the assumption is a lot more absentee ballots in this general election than we usually see based on our experiences so far during the pandemic. What are you watching for with how this affects our election?
So I think what I'm watching for is whether or not they are, you know, delivered in a timely fashion. Another is just it's a process, and a process that if you've never voted absentee before, you might not be familiar with. And so there are signatures to obtain and you know, timely delivery back to registrars of voters. So it's not merely a debate about whether or not the Postal Service is going to have the resources necessary to deliver and then pick up and return, but it's whether or not the public is accustomed to and is willing to sort of follow through with the entire process. So there's a lot of learning that has to go on, and there's a lot of education that has to go on here. And I think we also have to see whether or not local registrars of voters and towns and municipalities are creating avenues by which individuals can return them, maybe not through the mail, but having drop-off boxes and extra hours at certain facilities to make sure that people feel comfortable getting their ballot where it's supposed to go. So, you know, I think we're going to see some roll-off here in the sense of people are going to get their ballots but not return them. The question is what percentage of people is that going to happen to?
Now, we've seen a lot of politics over mail-in voting. The president and Attorney General Barr both raising concerns over election fraud, talking down mail-in voting. We're seeing some signs from Republican strategists in states like Florida saying, no, hold on. You're going to just discourage Republican voters from voting by mail. We want them to do that. What do you think of this Republican-Democrat split over voting by mail?
I mean, I think that, you know, there was sort of this message that was coming through from the White House. And so there was piggybacking on the drumbeat that was coming out of the administration. And Trump's attempt to try to discredit this kind of process, assuming that there's fraud in the system. But most states who use universal mail-in voting don't exhibit fraud to any meaningful extent. Yes, there's fraud in voting, but it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to find elections where the fraud impacted the outcome. And I think what's concerning for Republicans in general is that a lot of their base is older. I mean, the 18 to 25-year-olds have, over the last several elections, swung hard to the Democrats. And so if you've got a population cohort that might be apprehensive about showing up in person to vote, the mechanism is mail-in voting. And if you've told them that it's going to be problematic, you might just not get their vote at all. So I think that there's a reality and a pragmatism of this has to work for everybody. So we might as well encourage our voters to show up as well. And that's why all of a sudden you see the Republicans on the bandwagon.
Before I let you go, Charlie, I want to get your take on the state of the presidential race here in Wisconsin. Lots of polls showing a modest Biden lead in the state, 4%, 5%, 6% in that neighborhood. One out today from CNN, SSRS, showing a 10-point lead for Biden. I know with polls like that, sometimes you just look at the outlier and nod and then go back to the conventional wisdom. What do you think of the latest in polling?
I mean, I think what might be somewhat alarming for the Trump administration is that, you know, we haven't seen an election, probably in 20 years, where, you know, the Republican got higher than 49% of the vote. And most of the time, it's sort of hugging around 46 or 47%. Trump right now in the latest Marquette poll is sitting at around 44% of likely voters. He doesn't have much room for growth when Biden is already polling 48%. Those who refuse to answer, those who don't know, are only at about 4%. So this is a tight window that the Trump administration and the campaign has to try to get through. So it's going to be a foot race to the end, but one that Biden at the moment seems to have a little bit of a lead on that he might not relinquish.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
Charlie Jacobs is a professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. We talked to them about yesterday's state Supreme Court decision that kept the Green Party presidential ticket off the ballot and how it all fits in to the November election. Coming up, big oil is smaller than it used to be on the stock market and as a share of the economy. We'll find out why coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, wildfires have burned millions of acres in three western states and impacted air quality in other parts of the country. An expert on wildfires joins us to talk about why this year is so bad and how we can think differently about being prepared in the future. First, the coronavirus pandemic initially upended travel and caused the demand for oil to drop, so much so that in April, the price of some oil was less than zero for a little while. Our next guest has been looking into how the oil industry has fared in the last few months and over the last decade. He writes that big oil is in some ways being sized down. Dino Grandoni is an energy and environmental policy reporter for The Washington Post. Dino, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you for having me on.
Well, what are oil company profits looking like today compared to, say, 10-ish years ago?
Well, yeah, as you said, the oil industry is in a bit of a tailspin right now, especially given the coronavirus pandemic. We saw that in the normally busy driving months of April, May, and June, BP lost $16.8 billion, ExxonMobil lost $1.1 billion, and Chevron lost $8.3 billion. So these are big losses for these companies to be posting, especially for ExxonMobil, which had posted straight profits over the past two decades until this pandemic hit.
And we see kind of a key moment. You start your piece with the Dow Jones Industrial group of companies that they use. That's what gives us that Dow Jones number. They dropped a key oil company.
That's right. So the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped ExxonMobil from its index. It had been on that stock market index for 82 years, so long ago that when it first joined, it wasn't even called Exxon. It was called Standard Oil of New Jersey, an offshoot of the Standard Oil of Rockefeller fame. And the Dow Jones is a bit symbolic and oftentimes thought of as a bit antiquated in assessing the overall health of the stock market. It is notable that Exxon has dropped from it. Right now, there's only one oil company on that index, and that's Chevron, which is an indication of just how little at this point the oil industry is regarded as a part of the overall U.S. stock market.
And you also look at kind of the percentage of the economy that the oil industry is responsible for compared to everybody else. What kind of changes are we seeing there?
Well, what we've seen, the kind of theme over the past, let's say, decade or so has been one of the tech industry of Silicon Valley rising and of the oil industry declining. Right now you have a handful of companies, Amazon, Alphabet, which is Google's parent company, Facebook, Microsoft, all bigger than the entire U.S. oil and gas industry if you take a look at their stock market valuations. So right now it's fair to say that it's technology companies that are driving the U.S. economy, much less so than oil companies or much less so than energy companies are at this point, which had not been the case in the past. In the past, energy had been a huge portion of the economy, something like 15% when you take a look at the stock market.
Now, you were talking about the pandemic impact on the oil industry here, but it sounds like this is a bigger and longer running story than just 2020. What are the longer trends?
So one of the big important long-term trends is the decline of the price of oil even before the pandemic hit. As you noted, the price of West Texas Intermediate, which is this benchmark important price of oil out of Oklahoma, that went negative briefly for about a few hours back in April. But right now, oil is hovering around $40. But if you take a look back only a few years ago, it was $100. So when you're a company that was selling, is only able to sell its product for less than half of what it once was able to sell it for, that's not going to be good for your bottom line. Usually when all of your costs for producing will be the same or only down a little bit.
What is out there that's driving the downward price of oil?
Well, the oil market is driven by a lot of different complicated forces. Globally, you see, and a lot of it depends on whether or not these very large, countries with very large reserves decide to produce oil or decide not to produce oil. So if a country like Saudi Arabia decides to cut back on its production, that means that the price of oil might go up. If they decide to open up the spigot, the price of oil is going to go down. And that's actually something we saw during the pandemic or in the early days back in March and April, this price war between Russia and Saudi Arabia, where they both decided to kind of take down their quotas and signal that they're going to produce a lot of oil, which resulted in the price of oil to plummet.
Talking to Dino Grandoni from the Washington Post, energy and environmental policy reporter there, talking about his piece, looking at big oil getting smaller over the years. Dino, how about the jobs picture? I know there's a big boom in oil and natural gas production, which I think is part of the story here in the United States itself. How does oil fit in terms of job creation here in the U.S.?
So, you know, driven by those high over $100 per barrel prices that we saw in the past, you saw a surge in extraction jobs in Texas, North Dakota, Pennsylvania, peaking at a total of around over 200,000 industry positions nationwide at the end of 2014. But as prices dropped and as oil companies figured out ways to automate jobs, sector employment declined to 158,000 last December. And again, that's before even the pandemic hit, where we saw even more layoffs after that.
Now, you quoted analysts saying big oil companies are, quote, still a very meaningful and important part of the economy, regardless of where the stock is trading at the moment. These are still big companies, right? These are not just, you know, little mom and pop shops on the verge of closing down.
No, absolutely not. Although some of them will be going bankrupt or have said that they're going to be going bankrupt. But the very, very large oil companies are actually perhaps going to come out of this pandemic even stronger than they went in. Amid all this strife, some of the super majors could end up buying the assets of distressed companies. And it's often in the oil business that a period of contraction is followed by one of consolidation. So already we've seen one of these big purchases. Chevron recently acquired a Houston-based company called Noble Energy for $13 billion. They had some change left around and were able to make this purchase and might end up coming out bigger at the end of this whole thing.
On the horizon, how important are competing products for oil, like natural gas for, I guess, heating and other purposes, and electric cars that get their electricity from something other than oil for their energy source? Are these challenges for these big oil companies now or down the road?
Well, in the case of gas, these oil companies are often very often the ones producing the gas that goes into home heating or goes into electricity production. But when it comes to electric cars, right now they only represent about like a tiny fraction of auto sales. But you see investors pouring money into Tesla and into some other electric vehicle companies in the expectation that buyers and regulators are ready to make the internal combustion engine a thing of the past. And you also see some of the major players in Detroit, Ford and GM, investing a lot of money into building out their own electric fleets. So when we see the stock of a company like Tesla jumping through the roof, it's not so much because they have a bunch of new sales right now. It's about this expectation that they're going to be having a bunch of huge sales in the future.
And when we see something like declining shares on the stock market for oil companies, how much of that affects the reality of the challenges they face now, and how much of it is that expectation game, like you were just talking about with Tesla, fears of what it might be in the future?
Well, it's certainly a little bit of both. It reflects the reality of how much gasoline or other products these companies are able to sell, and it reflects an expectation about what they're able to do in the future. And it's up to markets to decide what the value of those two things and how to weigh between them, how to do that.
As we wrap up, what are you watching for next with this story of Big Oil?
Well, I am looking to see whether Congress is going to be passing another stimulus bill. Oil companies were, like a lot of other industries, beneficiaries of the last several that passed before the summer. You saw a bunch of oil companies tap different Federal Reserve programs to help stay afloat. And as that money starts running out, I'm curious to see whether Congress is going to step up and help again. That is going to help determine, you know, how well or how many of these companies are going to survive going forward.
Dino, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Dino Grandoni is an energy and environmental policy reporter at The Washington Post. He talked with us about his recent piece, Big Oil Just Isn't As Big As It Once Was. Coming up, wildfires have burned millions of acres in western states and even made sunsets here in Wisconsin look hazy. We'll talk with an expert on wildfires about whether we need to rethink the way we manage them in the future. Also, look at the roles of climate change and forest and fuel management in creating these outbreaks of wildfires. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, a Wisconsin finance writer shares advice on saving for retirement and how to make the best use of CD accounts. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, wildfires in western states, including California, Oregon, and Washington, have burned millions of acres this month and killed at least 27 people. They've also thrown a layer of smoke over major cities, and the haze has even reached us here in Wisconsin. The fires have become an issue on the campaign trail, too, with President Trump blaming forest management practices in western states, while Democratic candidate Joe Biden is focusing on climate change. Our next guest is an expert on fire and how humans have dealt with it for centuries. In a recent piece for the LA Times, he writes that we need to do more to be prepared for these events because, as he says, the fires are coming. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Stephen J. Pine is an emeritus professor at Arizona State University specializing in environmental history. His many books include Fire, A Brief History, and Between Two Fires, A Fire History of Contemporary America. Stephen, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you.
Can you, first of all, put this year's fires so far in context of our recent and non-recent past? How badly does this year stack up?
Well, it's certainly a historic year. I'm not sure I would call it unprecedented. I can think of historical prologues or precedents for most of the fires. What I can't imagine is having all of them at one time like this. And particularly for California, I can't imagine having 4 years of serial conflagrations like this. Traditionally, California would have a big fire. Then 5 or 7 or 10 years later, they'd have another big fire season. These are just a series of rolling thunders coming through. That's changed. Whether the fires become epic, I think, depends on how California and the country respond to them.
You recently wrote a piece where you compared the spread of wildfires to that of COVID-19. Different things, of course, but talk about some of the similarities you see.
Oh, well, any analogy breaks down, but it works out pretty nicely. Like virus, fire is not alive, but it feeds on. It propagates through the living landscape, so it has a lot of those same properties. We can think of, hardening your house against embers, which is the main source of ignition. It's like wearing a mask against aerosol dispersion. Defensible space, clearing around your house, is a lot like social distancing. Getting enough good fires on the landscape, well, that's a lot like herd immunity, allowing the good fires to keep the bad fires in check. So, and it also reminds us that fire is a social problem, that whatever you do, you're still at risk, depending on what your neighbors do.
You're not going to tell us that we could prevent fires from starting altogether. You say in all of your books, they're going to happen, but that mindset, knowing they're going to happen, how does that change the way we think about and prepare for fires?
Well, just walk back a second to the analogy. There's no vaccine for fire. So the best you can hope for is a kind of flu shot. So knowing that it's going to come, we've treated it as a kind of a freak. It's an emergency. It's an odd thing. In fact, in many cases, we're living in the fire equivalent of floodplains. We know they're going to come. And with all the changes that are happening, most of which are pushing towards a more fire-friendly environment, we're going to have them more often and perhaps more savage than we've had in the past. Knowing that it's there, it's not just something that we can make go away. I would hope, would argue for, taking some preventative measures. And there are all kinds of things we can do. Climate change, I mean, at some point we have to tackle that as soon as possible. But apart from that, there are lots and lots of things. Fire doesn't have a single driver. It's a reaction. It integrates everything around it. In some ways, it's like a driverless car. And that makes it complicated, but it also means that there are lots of points of intervention possible. There's not just one thing or two things we have to do. There are whole kinds of things we can do to begin tweaking how fire actually behaves on the landscape and how we interact with fire.
Talking to environmental historian Stephen J. Pine from Arizona State University, author of books including Fire, A Brief History. We're talking about our current wildfires in the United States and how to deal with them better, hopefully, in the future. Well, this is an election year. This has gotten political. I want to give a listen to each major party candidate offering their key point. First, President Trump focusing on forest and fuel management.
When trees fall down after a short period of time, about 18 months, they become very dry. They become really like a matchstick. And they get up, there's no more water pouring through. And they become very, very, they just explode.
And here's former Vice President Joe Biden, who kept climate change at the center of his remarks yesterday.
Donald Trump's climate denial may not have caused these fires and record floods and record hurricanes. But if he gets a second term, these hellish events will continue to become more common, more devastating, and more deadly.
As you're saying, Stephen, there's a lot going on to create a wildfire, and it might be different from one place to another. But let's look at each of those arguments. First of all, the president, elsewhere, he's argued that forests have been managed poorly. Fuel hasn't been removed. How much of a part of the story is that?
Well, one of the problems with fire is that it is so visceral and graphic that a lot of people latch onto it and the emotions it arouses to promote other agendas. And often these have very little to do with actually dealing with the fire. Because fire feeds on vegetation, the character of the vegetation is a big influence on fire and the kind of fire that occurs. But there's also a difference between biomass and fuel. And one of the things that converts biomass into fuel is the climate. So there, as in all these things with fire, there are interactions. Certainly, we've aggravated the fire scene in many places, not every place, by excluding fire and not finding some kind of surrogate for it. And this has allowed some places to overgrow. and to thicken in ways that can promote more fire. It also can cause ecological deterioration, particularly places that need sunlight, patches of open sky, and become overgrown and shaded. So there are a lot of reasons, you know, that it's certainly an important part. But I think if we had the same climate we had in the 1960s with the fuel structures we have today, we would be having big fires, but they wouldn't be this ferocious and they wouldn't be this frequent.
And let's take that now to the climate change side of things. Yeah. What, how is that raising our risk of fires and of big fires in particular?
Well, it's acting as a performance enhancer, if you will, on pre-existing conditions. And so we may have a poor fuel situation, but the climate is making it worse. The one of the big issues, though, with climate is that unlike fuels, the fuels are dependent. You know, they're specific to a particular place, but climate issues are globalizing fire concerns. So whether you manage your local scene well or not, it's going to be subject to the same kinds of exaggerations that climate change is imposing elsewhere. So, and there are lots of other things. I mean, how we build our structure, how we build our houses and communities. Power lines are a big issue for starting fires. You can have lots of fuel and a long drought or high winds, but if you haven't got a spark, you don't have fire. There are lots and lots of ways in which fire can come together.
And that last point is one I wanted to get to next, the fire triangle, which I think I learned about in one of your books. It's the fuel, the oxidizing agent, usually oxygen, and that ignition, the thing that ignites it in the first place. Sometimes that's lightning, and we can't do much about that, I guess. But could we make a difference in the human-caused ignitions of these fires?
Well, sure, we can. About 90% of fires nationally are set by humans. The larger fraction of lightning fires are set in the West, the interior West, the Rocky Mountains, and part of Central Florida, interestingly enough. But otherwise, these are things we do directly or deliberately or indirectly, say with power lines, catalytic converters on our vehicles that we then drive over dry grass. There are all kinds of ways we start. And interesting study has been done very recently looking at the climatic effects that we're seeing, particularly the lengthening of the spring dry period. And that makes it possible for fire season to expand, but that does, it isn't bringing fires. What we have are people igniting fires in that new condition. So it's the interaction of the two that is actually expanding the fire season. And many, many of our most disastrous fires have been started by machinery, by power lines, by abandoned campfires, in effect, by humans. Lightning fires tend to be in more remote areas, public lands, so they tend not to threaten communities in the same way.
We're talking with Stephen Pine right now, emeritus professor at Arizona State, author of books including Fire, A Brief History. We're talking about the wildfires happening right now and how to think about managing them in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for Stephen about the causes of wildfires or how we respond to them? What do you think could be done to make wildfires less damaging and deadly? Have you lived in a state, or do you live in a state, for that matter, where wildfires are a concern? What was your experience like? Do you see this as an out west problem or one that needs more national attention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about wildfires with Stephen Pine, emeritus professor at Arizona State and an expert on wildfire history and management. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about how and why wildfires start and or spread, or about the ways we try to contain them, to prevent them, to mitigate them? Do you think we need to change the approach that we take to wildfires in the future? If you have questions about climate change, forest management, anything related to this, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is, I'm wondering if we have any math formulated yet to give us an idea of how many metric tons of carbon and CO2 have been released by these current forest fires.
Interesting, Steve. Well, are forest fires a significant contributor to carbon emissions?
Yes and no. There's a difference between the kinds of fires we're seeing now and sort of prescribed or controlled burning, which basically operates on the surface, typically operates on the surface, and so all the stuff is recovered. And that's also true for forests in general, that eventually they rebuild, the carbon is restored. That's a big difference than, say, draining and burning off peat in Indonesia or clearing the Amazon and burning or fossil fuels, where you're taking stuff that's in deep storage or long-term storage and then releasing it. So forest fires can produce a dramatic impulse of released carbon, but generally they tend to be conservative in the sense that the landscape recovers. But part of the unknowns about our current situation is that with climate change and other things going on, we don't know what will come back exactly. So there could be a net transfer as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike, at 800-642-1234. I want to get a little more into the idea of keeping us humans from creating the spark that creates the fire, especially when conditions are ripe. What kind of practical changes? Does this mean we put power lines in different places, or, for example, or take better care of the strip of land on either side of a power line? What are some practical things we can do to prevent that spark hitting the fuel?
Well, there are lots of things you can do. There may be some selective burial. I think of a lot of places in California where we know where the winds are going to go. These are sort of fire floodplains. If you're upwind of a town, then that's a good place to bury it. Other places, you may have a more a smarter grid where you can route. You can turn it off selectively and reroute power other places. This may be a good argument for solar or renewables where it's locally stored, so you can have power lines shut down and still have power where you need it. California is getting some of the most notorious episodes of this, but the largest wildfire in New Mexico history was started by power lines. The fire outside Austin, Texas, Bastrop County, was started by power lines. Gatlinburg, Tennessee, burned a few years ago, and that was all started from power lines. So it's really a national issue, and we've needed to rebuild our grid for a long time anyway, and we could certainly build in fire protection as part of that.
Let's take a comment from Mary in Madison, who called in, says she heard that people whose houses burned down would simply rebuild on the same site. Mary asks, why haven't zoning laws been changed to prevent people from building in spots that are prone to fires? Is that part of the story, some kind of fire-related zoning, Stephen?
Well, that's part of it. There's certainly a lot of discussion going on about mapping places of high hazard, very similar to problems in earthquake zones or river floodplains or coastal. And then, you know, it's very hard to tell Americans they can't build where they want. And we build in all those places. And so it's difficult to say because of fire, you're not going to be allowed to rebuild in the same way. In fact, people do rebuild, and mostly we cheer them on. You know, they're thrown off the horse, they're getting back on. They're showing some pluck, determination. They're going to go through this hard time. They're going to rebuild and they're going to reestablish their lives again. But there are also social costs to that. And they may be at risk again. And this has happened. There was an old a joke many years ago. It was produced in California and showed a series of comparative slides, one showing a chaparral that's burned and then regrowing. And next to it was a community. It's kind of macabre humor. And then it's burned, and then they show it rebuilding, beginning with the, you know, frame house and the rest of it. And there's a certain sense in which that's true. But it's also, it's not just restricted to fire.
Right. And we've had a problem. If I have tens of millions of dollars and want to build a building in San Francisco, I have to put in certain earthquake type constructions. Are there things like that, whether it's in the construction itself or the gaps in vegetation or whatever, are there things like earthquake mitigation that we could do for construction for fire mitigation?
Yes. And in fact, we've been doing it for a long time for cities. I mean, that our cities used to burn as often as the surrounding countryside, so they were made of the same materials, but we stopped. And it wasn't just because we have fire engines and hydrants, it's because we have building codes and standards and zoning. But the problem is when we get into these rural or in many cases ex-urban communities, we haven't defined them as urban. We think of this as a rural or a wildland fire problem with houses in it. In many respects, it makes more sense to think of it as a little bits of cities with funny landscaping. And if you did that, then you would automatically begin applying all of these standards that we have developed over a long period of time to protect cities from being destroyed by fires.
Reading your LA Times piece, Stephen, I feel like I get a little sense of frustration that we get real excited about wildfires when they're happening. But if we'd done some stuff over the last, I don't know, 20 years, these wildfires might not be so bad now. What kind of things do we need to be doing even when the wildfire isn't on the TV screen?
It's very hard to get interest in fire unless it's news. It's like a fever, then it breaks, and then it's gone. There are a lot of things about getting our communities ready for the next fire and hardening them against embers. Embers are the main point of vulnerability. So it's not that fires come through like a tsunami of flame. They come through like a swarm of flaming locusts. So we understand that, and we can target that. We can also do better stuff around the surrounding environments, maybe think about green belts of various kinds. And we can be thinking about our wildlands, how to get a better fire-resilient landscape there. They will continue to burn, but they may not burn quite as savagely. And it may be easier to stop those fires when they come. So there are lots of things. This is not something new. We don't need a crash program in fire science. We've known about this stuff for a long time, and there's a whole reservoir of traditional knowledge that was suppressed and needs to be recovered as well. You know, humans have lived with fire all of our existence as a species. We're a species monopolist for fire. We're the keystone species for fire. It's only in the last century or two when we really converted to fossil fuels that we forgot how to live with fire and living landscapes.
In our last few moments, I know you early in your career worked on fire crews. What are your thoughts right now, what we should be thinking about for the people stretched thin right now fighting these fires?
Well, we should be thinking that firefighter safety counts, and we should not be putting people at risk for circumstances where they really can't make a difference. We need to be selective in where we apply our force, where we are willing to commit firefighters. The job can be dangerous. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be lethal. We should be responsible and not expect. You know, we've created in places like California where you have a nature that's given, built to burn and explosively burn, and we've got a society that wants to build where and when it wants to, and we've had our fire crews standing between as a buffer. And I think we've reached the point where we can't do that anymore. It just isn't physically possible, and it isn't, in a sense, morally responsible to ask them to do that. We have to stand up and begin managing fire smartly, and we have to design our communities for the fact that fires are going to come.
Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
You too. That's Stephen J. Pine, Emeritus Professor at Arizona State University, specializing in environmental history. He's written a lot of books about fire, including Fire, A Brief History. We talked to him about the wildfires in the western U.S. now and how we can rethink fire management in the future. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, Kate talks to the mayor of Kenosha about the city's efforts to rebuild trust in community after the police shooting of Jacob Blake and the protests that followed. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then vinyl albums are outselling CDs for the first time in a long time, and digital streaming keeps getting bigger. We'll dig into the changing ways we consume our music. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.